from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More fallout from the Snowden revelations of spying by the U.S. on its allies. France has called for an explanation for the unacceptable and shocking reports of NSA spying on French citizens. Leaked documents reported by the French newspaper Le Monde revealed that the U.S. spy agency recorded millions of phone calls and emails and monitored the internet activities of French government and business officials. U.S. Ambassador to France Charles Rivkin was summoned by the French Foreign Ministry to account for the espionage allegations this morning. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius told the press that he had instructed the U.S. ambassador to appear this morning at the ministry's Quai d'Orsay headquarters.
The foreign minister said we'd already been alerted in June and we reacted strongly, but obviously we need to go further. These kinds of practices between partners that violate privacy are totally unacceptable. We must ensure quickly that these practices are no longer repeated.
The French Interior Minister Manuel Valls also spoke out on national television against U.S. spying practices, citing the Le Monde report. Valls said, quote, "The revelations on Le Monde are shocking and demand adequate explanations from the American authorities in the coming hours," closed quote. It went on to say that it was totally unacceptable for an allied country to spy on France. Le Monde revealed in a report based on the security leaks of former CIA worker Edward Snowden that the NSA recorded 70.3 million phone calls between December 10, 2012 and January 8, 2013. According to the report, the spying was not just limited to citizens suspected of being involved in terrorism. Citing data released by Snowden, it said the NSA also eavesdropped on politicians and prominent business figures. Ramin Mazahiri is an independent journalist based in Paris. He spoke with Press TV earlier today.
Ramin, it does seem the French government has responded, and it seems quite angry.
Yes, it is angry, and it's certainly understandable. As you said, the U.S. ambassador has been recalled, and he's going to have to explain the actions of the United States. I think it's really very clear we are talking about a less than 1 month period that has taped more than 70 million phone calls. This is under the guise of terrorism. Well, there's just no way that terrorists made 70 million phone calls in about 4 weeks. So what they are saying here in France is that this spying is extending to other domains. They are spying on politicians. They are spying on industrial leaders, and this is something that is very, very different than going after terrorism. People are going to say that France shouldn't react because France has their own domestic spying program, which was revealed by Snowden. Well, if France is spying on French citizens, that's one thing, but these revelations show that the U.S. is spying in a foreign country, and that's really a horse of a different color. The previous Snowden revelations about Mexico show that what the U.S. is doing is they are getting a competitive advantage through industrial espionage. They are able to make more competitive investments. They are able to make smarter investments. Maybe here in France, people are saying, well, maybe the U.S. is trying to steal our industrial designs for, nuclear reactors or electric cars. So people are going to say, France shouldn't be overreacting because they spy too, but that's really not the case. There is going to be repercussions here, just as there were in June, mainly regarding the U.S.-EU free trade treaty, which is something that the U.S., of course, being so free market, so neoliberal, that they push for so strongly. But even back in July, with the first Snowden revelations, they say, how can we have a free trade agreement when our allies are spying on us? And that was just in a political point of view. Now, people are going to say, well, this is very much more concrete, that how can we have a free trade agreement with people who are doing probably industrial espionage and having this vast, vast spying campaign? So this is probably going to get more and more serious, and it's going to be interesting to see how the U.S. tries to justify taping 70 million conversations in less than a month, and it would be amusing if they say, well, these are all terrorist-related.
And Ramin, you're on the ground there in France. So I want to ask you, how would French react to, you know, the argument put forth that everyone gathers intelligence on other countries?
Well, I mean, it's one thing. Like, for example, back in July, you know, the Snowden revelations showed that the U.S. was eavesdropping on the French embassy, that they were eavesdropping on the United Nations. Well, I mean, if you want to say that that's politics and that's what people do, that's fine. But the U.S. is constantly lambasting China for not respecting copyright law, for, you know, stealing other people's designs, for committing industrial espionage. Well, I mean, that's what people, you know, especially because of what Mexico is saying, that the U.S. is using, you know, what they get, you know, what they steal to get a competitive advantage. That's not political. That's going into, you know, the U.S., the U.S.'s claims that they are the best and the most efficient economy. Well, if it's based on stolen information, that's something that is going to, I mean, that hurts the French economy. That leads to higher unemployment here. You know, that's money that is being sent, being made not by French people, but by Americans. So now we're talking about money. We're not just talking about, you know, eavesdropping on diplomats. Now we're talking about, you know, so many taped conversations. What domain is the U.S. not spying on? So back in July, it was just political. Now, the question is, you know, what aren't they covering? And it's probably commercial stuff. It's probably, you know, local political stuff like that. And who really knows?
So then, Ramin, going forward, you know, you did say that there may be some repercussions to this vis-a-vis the free trade agreement, etc. But diplomatically speaking, do you think that the French government will take this any further beyond just summoning this U.S. ambassador?
Well, we all know that the U.S. and France work hand in glove, and that the U.S. and France pretty much control, you know, I don't know, 60% of the world, right? And we know that whatever the U.S. and France wants, you know, from places like the United Nations, they get. With the rare exception of Syria, that was really something. So you have two allies that work so closely together, and now it's clear that, you know, there is still a competition. And I think that the U.S. is, because they, you know, they have a, you know, bigger economy, four times the population, they're going to say, well, this is all part of healthy competition, and you guys shouldn't be surprised, and you guys are doing it too. How far is it going to go? It's hard to say. I mean, you know, politicians here are going to score a lot of points, as they should, you know, because their people are being spied on by, you know, foreign people, and they have to stand up and say, look, we can defend our own citizens from these types of attacks and, you know, espionage activities.
Heavy rains again caused an overflow at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, said it was attempting to discern the quality of the water and possible radioactivity, which may have been spilled. TEPCO announced today that water had overflowed in 12 areas of the plant. Masaki Iotaki, a reporter for the Japanese international news agency NHK World, reports.
Workers at Fukushima Daiichi have been struggling for months with leaks of contaminated water. Now they're dealing with another problem, rain. They saw a heavy downpour last week during a typhoon. And on Sunday, another storm brought more than 100 millimeters of rain. All that water built up inside various surrounding tanks that store contaminated water. Workers discovered it had flowed over the barriers at 11 spots. In six areas, they detected levels of radioactive strontium above the government safety limit. The highest reading was more than 70 times the standard. Now the workers are trying to find out whether some of the water flowed through ditches and into the Pacific Ocean. The barriers are designed to contain any tainted water that leaks from the tanks. The walls are fitted with drainage pipes. Initially, whenever it rained, workers opened the pipes to discharge rainwater. But in August, they found that 300 tons of highly radioactive water had leaked from one of the tanks. It traveled through a pipe to the area beyond the barrier. Workers decided to shut off all the pipes and pump out any water that collected inside the containment area. They now check the pumped out water for radioactivity to ensure it meets government standards. Heavy rains are making that job a lot harder. Managers plan to install more pumps around the tanks to make sure they can deal with any amount of water. They say they don't want to get caught out the next time a storm hits. Masaki Otake, NHK World.
Heavy rains had caused water to flow over the barriers of an artificial embankment surrounding a dozen tanks of radioactive water at the plant. TEPCO reported that liquid containing a source of beta radiation was found beyond the levees. The company said the incident was, quote, due to heavy rains in the Tohoku region, closed quote. They said they were attempting to identify the amount of leaked water and the radiation levels present in the fluids. Radioactivity levels in a well near a storage tank at Fukushima have risen immensely, according to the plant operator earlier, fueling ongoing concern about the impact of radiation on the surrounding environment and the Pacific Ocean. Earlier this month, TEPCO had announced that 430 liters of polluted water spilled from a tank as company employees tried to remove rainwater dumped at the plant by recent typhoons. They said that the water may have flowed into the Pacific Ocean. The power plants were damaged in March 2011 by a massive earthquake and tsunami. It sparked a nuclear crisis, with meltdowns occurring in three reactors. It was considered to be the world's worst nuclear accident since the Chernobyl disaster in 1986. 2 years after the murder of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi by U.S.-backed fighters in Libya, Russian media received a letter from Gaddafi's widow, Safiya Farkash. She wrote, quote, in the memory of NATO's aggression against my country, which turned Libya into chaos, and in the memory of my husband, whom I consider to be a martyr, I demand that all the members of the UN Security Council, the European Union, and everyone who has direct or indirect connection with this murder tell where the remains of these martyrs are and allow their relatives to bury them in a proper way. I also demand that the African Union, of which Muammar Gaddafi was a founder, should investigate the murder of him and all the people who were with him on that day. She added, quote, I demand that the world community help me get in touch with my son Saif al-Islam, who has been isolated from all of the members of our family since his arrest. Saif's only crime is that he warned that the revolution could only lead Libya to chaos, which is something that we are witnessing now, closed quote.
I need to study!
Sergeant White, we gotta study!
It's midterms week!
I have 2 midterms due tomorrow!
I need books in the library! This is a public institution!
I paid to
How you want the public institution?
I paid full tuition for this!
I want to study!
That was the sound at City College of New York outside the Guillermo Morales Asada Shakur Student and Community Center yesterday as the city administration shut the building, including the library, on the Sunday before midterms and closed the community center without notice. School officials reportedly placed a new sign in front of the center that reads, Center for Professional Development, while a university press release reportedly announced that the center was closed and is going to be converted to a career resource center. Books, documents, and personal belongings of students were removed from the center and are being held and, according to the press release, examined. Police arrested David Suker, a former CCNY student who sat in front of the door of the center.
We're asking you to leave. If you don't leave, you're under arrest. Ma'am, I'm the same thing with you. We're asking you to leave the building. If you don't leave the building, you're under arrest.
I'm a journalist. I'm just trying to make sure everything's okay.
Doesn't matter. Please shut off the camera. Are you leaving? Are you leaving?
I have a question.
Yes.
I have my personal possessions inside. Can I get my personal possessions?
Tomorrow.
No, I need them now.
Tomorrow. Are you leaving? If not, you're under arrest.
My personal possessions.
If you're not, you're under arrest.
My personal possessions.
You're under arrest.
May I get my personal possessions?
You're under arrest.
The incident follows the September 17th arrest of 6 CUNY members who were peacefully protesting the appointment of disgraced former CIA director David Petraeus as a lecturer. Students won the use of the Morales Shakur Center space as a result of the 1989 CUNY student strike against a proposed tuition increase. The purpose of the space was for students to engage in activism and build links with the surrounding Harlem and Washington Heights communities. The administration has tried to retake the space from student activists several times and was caught engaging in video surveillance of the space in 1998. However, students and community members had, until yesterday, successfully fended off repeated administrative attacks.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is officially past midnight. Marriage is equal in New Jersey.
I now, by the power vested in me, thank God, by the state of New Jersey, it's about time, I declare Joseph and Orville to be lawful spouses in the state of New Jersey.
That was Senator-elect Cory Booker from New Jersey shortly after midnight early today, as he officiated at that state's first-ever same-sex marriages. Meanwhile, hours after same-sex couples started exchanging vows at midnight ceremonies across the state, Governor Chris Christie announced today that he would drop his legal challenge to same-sex marriage, a reversal from an earlier position that voters must decide the issue. The reversal came on the heels of a ruling by the state Supreme Court Friday that rejected his attempt to block the marriages until the appeal was resolved. His decision effectively removed the last hurdle to making same-sex marriage legal in New Jersey. A transit strike in the San Francisco Bay Area of California is in its fourth day. Frustrated commuters started the work week today with gridlocked roadways and long lines for buses and ferries. At the same time, federal investigators were searching for clues to a weekend train crash that killed two workers. They said Sunday that even though the train that killed the two workers did not have a front-facing video recorder, interviews, inspections, audio recordings, and camera footage from the train's cab should provide enough evidence to determine the cause. Union organizer and political activist Gloria LaRiva spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar about the issues facing the transit workers, including the tactics that management has been using against them.
On October 18th, workers at Northern California's Bay Area Rapid Transit System, or BART, held their second strike this year after a deadline to resolve contract negotiations passed without a deal. BART is the nation's fifth largest public transportation network and serves 400,000 riders each day. Party for Socialism and Liberation organizer Gloria LaRiva joins the program to discuss what's happening as well as what labor wants.
The Bay Area Rapid Transit System is a huge transportation system that reaches across dozens of cities, and it is an inconvenience. But the unions of the BART workers took a very, very serious decision. They have a virtually unanimous support of their workers who have really taken it on the chin for so many years, and they've said, we're not going to take it anymore. We have a right to dignity on the job. We have a right to safety. We have a right to better wages and health care, pension, different conditions for union workers. They've taken a stand. It's very important that the community and the public support them. On Friday, October 18th at 12:01 a.m., the workers who are represented by three unions in the BART transit system, which is the subway system of Northern California, BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, went on strike. After several months of obstinate position by the management, which really was planning and hoping that the workers would go on strike, the workers have been without a wage increase. They had to accept a wage freeze 5 years ago, and this time with BART running at a surplus, an expected surplus of billions of dollars in the next 10 years, the workers are demanding an increase and improvements in their wages, benefits, and work conditions. It also involves demands regarding their safety. There is a lot of safety issues that are at play, both in running the transit system and also needing more protection for their workers from the public. Sometimes they're facing danger in their booth where they accept the tickets or where they have to face the public. On the last week, twice, the BART management presented first a last and final offer after the union and management had been making progress in their negotiations. And that final offer was what many believed to have been a maneuver by the management to try to force a strike. On Sunday, October 13th, as the management and unions were making progress in their negotiations, which were very intense, the last minute in the afternoon, the BART management presented the union with a final and last offer. That's really throwing down the gauntlet. And so the workers issued a 72-hour notice, which they give as a courtesy to notify the public that they will be going on strike. But the negotiations were continued for four more days until Thursday afternoon. And according to the union, the economic issues were almost basically resolved. Much progress had been made in the negotiations. And then again, the BART management presented a last-minute order on changes in the work rules. This was again forcing the union into an intolerable situation. The unions feeling very, very much that it would be difficult to go on strike, the unions said, let's go to arbitration. Arbitration is where a neutral party comes in, hears the issues in dispute, and then makes a binding decision. That is, both parties, management and unions, have to abide by an agreement of an outside arbitrator. The unions proposed this, the management refused, and that's when the unions decided enough is enough, we have to go on strike. And that's what's taking place right now.
What is the management's intention to force this issue when the unions have been generous enough to make so many concessions?
I believe that what is at stake here in the BART struggle is much more than the issue of wages and benefits in the immediate sense. It's similar to the trend that's taken place in Wisconsin and Ohio, where even traditionally union-strong industrial states have now passed right-to-work laws and on the offensive against workers' rights, unions' rights. Here in California, the legislators in the state assembly, some of the more anti-union right-wing, are demanding to pass legislation in the state if the BART unions were to go on strike to effectively ban all strikes by public transit workers. That would have an effect throughout California. And that's why the BART unions, the three unions that represent the more than 2,000 workers, were very, very reluctant to go on strike. When workers go on strike, it's a huge sacrifice. You face the risk of losing your job, and even worse, the union is at great risk. But there comes a time when you have to take a stand and say that the organized labor has a right to withhold their labor when management is completely obstinate. Unfortunately, the media has had a very negative effect among many passengers of the BART system who are denouncing the workers for going on strike, saying they make too much money when in fact they barely make a living wage in the Bay Area. The Party for Socialism and Liberation is a workers' organization, and we believe that the workers must be defended. They represent the rights for all people, and it's important that they win this struggle, that they win this strike. We're solidly behind them, along with many other organizations and unions that are on the picket line. So what is at stake here is, we believe, the ruling class of California wanting to place a future ban on the strikes of public transit workers. It could have an effect nationally as well. And yet, the media in the Bay Area has played a very, very negative role, simply portraying the BART workers as higher paid than other workers. They claim, oh, the average wages are $63,000. Well, in the Bay Area, it's estimated that you need $90,000 for a family of four to even be able to survive in the Bay Area. And that's not even being able to afford buying a home. It's just getting by in this state, and especially in San Francisco and the Bay Area. So those wages are not that great. Plus, nobody talks about what management makes. Management makes $300,000, $400,000 in their salary.
Even if the union and management can come to terms with this strike, where do you see this issue going in the future?
For unions which are clearly on the defensive and still are the front line for the whole working class of the United States, because workers and unions are organized, they're represented, they have rights, they can sit down with management, negotiate for better terms, conditions, dignity on the job. And the unions are in different industries, whether it's public or private workers, are facing many, many challenges. This is an offensive that's taken place for years with the corporation's advantage of using technology and anti-labor laws. So for the unions, they need much more support from the community. And as many unions are now recognizing, there's a need for union, non-union, and community organizations, the community, the public in general, to organize together to defend all workers' rights. I think what we're seeing with the low-wage workers of fast food and in New York and other cities demanding a living wage of a minimum wage of at least $15 an hour, that's part of this whole struggle. And yet, I think that the media wants to pit union workers, as in the case of Wisconsin or California here with the BART strike, the union workers as having too much. And why can't they sacrifice like all other workers? Well, we have to put on the table the demand, why are the corporations making the highest profits ever in history, in the history of capitalism, while the workers are getting poorer and poorer, where half of the U.S. population is either officially poor or near poverty? And it's the unions, which are the vanguard for all workers, but they cannot hope to advance and defend union rights and future unionized workers' rights unless we broaden this movement. And I believe that's what many, many unions are starting to look to.
And finally, the People's Organization for Progress, based in Newark, New Jersey, is one of the largest community-based people's organizations in the United States. This past weekend, POP sponsored a People's Conference for Jobs, Peace, Equality, and Justice at the Paul Robeson Campus Center at Rutgers University in Newark. Journalist Glenn Ford, publisher of Black Agenda Report, spoke at the conference.
Even down in Tennessee and Georgia, when you ask the question correctly, they're for national health care, and I'm not talking about Obamacare. They're for affordable housing for all as well, just as the people in this room are. It gets more complicated after that. And the reason that these popular demands that commonsensical people all can agree on should be expected from in the lives of Americans. The reason that we are not able to achieve any of them is because this system is controlled thoroughly by a small group of people concentrated on Wall Street, what the Occupy movement called the 1%, actually some very small fraction of 1% of the people. And when we say they control the system, that means the Democratic Party as well. That means our Black Democratic president, and it most definitely means your new senator-elect, Cory Booker. Now, it's not that the Democrats don't think that you and most people are serious about a living wage and about health care and about affordable housing and all the rest. They certainly know that Black people are serious about these issues because Black folks are recognized as the most progressive constituency in the country. And all of these items come under the broad heading of the historical Black political consensus on social justice and peace. There is no question about where we are regarding those issues.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio in New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thanks for listening.